I am so thrilled to be joined again by, I can now call her legitimately friend of the pod, Ann Curzan from the University of Michigan, who I was fortunate to hear talk about her new book, Says Who, A Kinder, Funner Usage Guide for Everyone Who Cares About Words, at exactly the same time as I was writing a piece for the Folger Shakespeare Library about Shakespeare and TikTok, and is TikTok the new Shakespeare in terms of creating new words and originating new phrases and popularizing them in the way that Shakespeare did 400 years ago? So my article's already written, so it's in the can and it's posted. And but what do you think about that? What do you think about internet and Shakespeare?
Let me start with Shakespeare, just because as a historian of the language, you end up spending a lot of time thinking about, writing about, reading Shakespeare, because he's such an important figure in the record of the history of English.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, whatever it is, wherever you are. I'm Austin Tischner, co-artistic director of the Reduced Shakespeare Company, and you're listening to this week's Reduced Shakespeare Company podcast, now in its 19th year, number 944, Shakespeare's Language Playfulness. Professor of English Linguistics and podcast host Ann Curzan spoke with me last July of 2024 about her book, Says Who, A Kinder, Funner Usage Guide for Everyone Who Cares About Words. We continued our conversation recently to talk specifically about Shakespeare's contributions to the English language, not the least of which might have been his playfulness with words.
He clearly enjoyed language. He had a great ear for language. And here might be a connection with the internet, that from what we can tell, he was a popularizer of bits of language, the same way that a good meme,
yeah,
if it takes off on the internet, is suddenly everywhere. And it is, I will say, one of the fascinating things about being a linguist or a historian of a language right now is to try to figure out what the internet is going to do as a factor in language change, because it is allowing language to spread at a speed that we have never seen before. That if you think about Shakespeare's time, you get a new word in London. Well, for it to even get to the north of England, the people have to get there.
Right.
Which will take some time. And then, so language is going to change slowly. And for it to get across the ocean is going to take a lot of time. But now you have a meme, you have a song, it introduces a new word. That word can spread around the world, literally around the world, in seconds.
Yeah.
And we've never seen anything like this. So what that will mean in terms of the speed or scope of language change is still to be determined. But anyway, Shakespeare.
I was going to say, to coin a phrase, it is a brave new world.
Exactly. And wow, did he record a lot of idioms?
Right.
And I try to be careful with Shakespeare around using the word record, because he is often the first person to give us the written record of a word.
Right.
And some of those, from everything we can tell, he coined, particularly, for example, a functional shift where he takes a noun and he makes it a verb. And so his audience would have known how to interpret that, because they know what the noun means and now it's a verb and we can figure that out.
And context clues and all of it. Yeah.
Exactly. Or putting a prefix on or a suffix and creating a new word. But he also recorded a lot of new borrowings, and he had a great ear for what was happening in the language and getting it into his plays. Mm-hmm. And the editors of the Oxford English Dictionary, so the Oxford English Dictionary, which is this amazing historical record of English words that tries to tell the story of every English word, well, the contributors and the editors of the Oxford English Dictionary relied very heavily on Shakespeare, because they had access to his plays and his poetry. And so they used it a lot in terms of quoting and using it to define the meaning of words. Now there is a little bit of a sport, which is trying to predate the first date in the Oxford English Dictionary. Because now that we have these big databases of text, you can go search for a word and see if you can find an earlier instance. And sometimes you can. And so there are places where Shakespeare was the first quote, and over the years, people have found something that's a little bit earlier, but Shakespeare would have made helped to make that popular because of the popularity of his work.
We had to, we literally had to go back and forth several times on the edit for my my Folger post about what's the number. What number do we quote? It was 1700. Now it's like 14 and change. And we ended up going, you know what? Many, many hundreds, I think is what we ended up saying.
I love that. And then, you know, one of the ways I use Shakespeare as a scholar and is that when I'm trying to help people think about the history of a construction, and here we could think about singular they, gender neutral they, which has been used as a singular pronoun for centuries. And I will admit that one of the ways that I will legitimize something is to say, it's even in Shakespeare. And people say, it was in Shakespeare. Well, if it was in Shakespeare, then it must have been legitimate. And Shakespeare helps me because he had such a good ear that of course he was using singular they, because the people around him, and probably he himself, were using singular they in their speech. And so you find it in his plays, and then I can cite his plays to say, look at this singular they.
Yeah. Well, and it's so it's so much easier when you adopt it, and then you don't have to go he or she or he, or that awful S/he, you know, which was just ugly, clumsy and ugly.
Exactly. And this, I've been working on that pronoun issue for decades, most of my career. And, you know, so I've studied the history of where the rule that I grew up with, I don't know about you, but I grew up with the rule that you were supposed to use he as the generic.
Yeah. I guess I don't know whether that was a rule or whether it was just my own idiocy preferring, because I'm a dude, you know, that's how you did it. I didn't know it was a rule.
It was a rule. It was what I grew up with, was that you should say a teacher should learn his students' names, and that I, even though my pronoun is she, that I am included in that he. I will say it didn't feel particularly inclusive to me. And that by the time I was in junior high school, things were loosening up, and we were given this advice, as you say, you can use he or she, he slash she, or S slash he, or I will say advice that has always seemed odd to me, like change pronouns by paragraph.
Yeah.
Which I think can be a little disconcerting for a reader.
Keep the reader guessing.
Exactly. Or, you know, rewrite the whole sentence so you don't need a pronoun. And what I've learned over time is that the question we should have been asking, the says who question, is who said we can't write down singular they? Right. Because we use it in speech. And even the people to this day who don't like singular they probably use it in speech in a sentence such as, someone who knows where they're going should give us directions. Someone who knows where they're going. That is a singular they. It sounds natural and grammatical to almost all of us. It goes by below the radar. So when you ask that question of why can't we write it down, you don't actually have very good reasons. And so I have tried to shift the argument to, let's really talk through why you can't write it down. And people will make a couple of arguments. They will say a pronoun can't be singular and plural at the same time.
Right.
Which we already know is not true, because you have a pronoun like you, which is singular and plural at the same time. And then they will say, well, it's confusing. It can be ambiguous, which is fair. And one of the examples I use in the book is that you can have a sentence such as, my mother and her friend were in the driveway and they said.
Right.
And the question is, okay, did both of them say that? Does your mother's friend use they as their pronoun? Does your mother use they as their pronoun? What is happening here? We don't know. But if we did that same sentence and said, my mother and her friend were in the driveway and she said,
mm-hmm.
we still have ambiguity.
Right.
Was it your mother or your mother's friend? We don't know. And this is where in writing, you would just need to rewrite that sentence because pronouns can be ambiguous. He, she, they, it, they all can be ambiguous.
And the friend said.
And the friend said, exactly. And in speech, we would figure it out.
Yeah.
In writing, we have to be more careful. And that is the thing I wish someone had told me as a developing writer.
Yeah.
Which is what makes writing hard. I mean, there are multiple things, but one of the things that makes writing hard is that it cannot tolerate the level of ambiguity that speech can.
Yes. Clarity begins at home, as they say.
And so you do have to be more careful as a writer because you're not there to clarify.
Yeah.
Don't have the context that you usually have with speech. So some of the rules that we learn are designed to help us minimize the ambiguity in writing, and that is helpful.
Hi, I'm Guy Roberts, Artistic Director of Prague Shakespeare Company, and you're listening to the Reduced Shakespeare Company podcast.
Where can you RSC the RSC? This March of 2025, we'll return to the Merrimack Repertory Theater in Lowell, Massachusetts for the three-week Lort Theater premiere of The Comedy of Hamlet, a prequel. And in April and May of 2025, we're bringing back an updated version of All the Great Books Abridged and performing it in Bristol, Tennessee, Harrisonburg, Virginia, Louisville, Kentucky, Elyria, Ohio, Bloomsburg, Pennsylvania, and Rhinelander, Wisconsin. Check out the touring page at our website, ReduceShakespeare.com, or our social media pages for venue and ticket information. Now back to my conversation with Anne Curzan, talking about how Shakespeare shaped the English language and in many ways shaped our approach to it. The last time you were on the podcast, about how you discover things as you write. As I was writing my Folger piece about TikTok and language, I realized I'd already sort of believed that Shakespeare's playhouses were sort of the internet of the day. It's where people came to gather. But it felt like Shakespeare's plays specifically are the TikTok, the social medium of the day. People come, this is where people hear words, they share gossip, they entertain each other, they see others and are seen by others. You know,
they play with language. I love that. I love the example of a thing that you figured out in writing and a way to think about a historical moment in relation to a current one. Mm-hmm. And the celebration of play with language, that to me is such an important shift in mindset.
Yeah.
When we think about something like slang, which is a kind of language that for a long time has been disparaged as sloppy language, bad language. And I think that slang needs to be seen as language at its most creative and yeah. playful and irreverent and sometimes just delightful.
Forgive me, I'm looking around at all my shelves. I have a dictionary of slang somewhere in this office and I can't find where it is. I see the one behind you.
Yes, I have many dictionaries of slang and scholars, colleagues who study slang and have written brilliant books on slang as the people's poetry, which I think is a great description. But again, it's a place where we can affirm younger people and other communities that tend to use slang to say slang is fascinating
yeah.
and fun and poetic, often makes brilliant use of metaphor. It's such fun to study and learn from.
Well, and you mentioned the people's poetry, which is an expression I love. We talked, I think, last time a little bit about the slang and younger people using, they code switch. They know how to, they use a different language for when they're texting, for instance, than they do when they're writing a paper. Maybe I've been lucky and in a privileged bubble, but most of the young people I know can write a paper and know the difference.
Absolutely. And that has been my experience as well. And all of us, particularly through our schooling, we're developing writers. And young people are writing more than they probably ever have, mm-hmm. because they're texting and they're posting on social media and they can blog and, they are writing a lot. And there are people who will argue that the quantity has gone up, but the quality has gone down. I don't know that I'm totally convinced by that. I think we're seeing more writing.
Yes.
And so you're seeing a wide range of writing. And that, as you said, part of learning as a writer is how to navigate different genres, different audiences, different purposes, and different contexts. And sure, as you're working through it, you may sometimes have one genre bleed into another genre in a way where people are like, oh, I'm not sure that works. But that's part of learning to be a writer. It's also how genres change over time, is that you get some of that bleed over. But one of my favorite examples about the differences is that with texting, my students have taught me all about punctuation and how to use it on texting. And so I learned from students now many years ago, but they said, you need to know that the period at the end of a text is serious and potentially angry. And yeah. I did not know that. It has forever changed the way that I text. They did say, we do know that older people are not aware of this, and we try to read their text final periods differently, but it can be a little jarring because in texting, where language is moving very fast, but you don't have tone and you don't have facial expression, punctuation has needed to be repurposed to do some of that work. So the period is angry and the exclamation mark is showing that you're smiling or happy, and the dot, dot, dot is showing skepticism or that you're waiting for something. And they think about how many exclamation marks you use and what does it mean if there's no punctuation? That's more neutral. And when I do this with students and I say, thank you for teaching me all of this because I am not a particularly savvy texter, then I can say, I happen to have spent a lot of time gaining control over academic punctuation.
Yeah, yeah.
And I am happy to share that knowledge with you so that if you would like to navigate this space successfully, you can have that knowledge. And my experience is that people are much more open to learning things when it is not presented as, this is the right way to use punctuation. And if you don't know it, then you need to step up. And I don't know what was going on with your education that you don't know this. But instead, here's a different set of conventions, which I can show you. And thank you for showing me your conventions, because now I have more tools in my toolbox.
Yes, it's an exchange of ideas from warring factions. Thank you for sharing with me your language and your punctuation. You were talking about blending genres and knowing your audience, and that takes us back to Shakespeare, too. For my money, his tragedies and histories are far funnier than they are frequently performed, and his comedies are more serious and grounded in truth and pain than they are usually done. Mm-hmm. He was a master of mixing genres, and he knew who his audience were. Was? He knew who his audience was. He knew the people he was playing for were. Help me, Anne. What am I doing wrong there?
Yeah, well, you've just run into a set of nouns that are tricky. So the jury is, the jury are, and we have a British-American distinction there where that collective noun can be dealt with as a singular noun because it's collective or as a group of people. And so it is plural because we're talking about a group of people. So completely fair to be confused about which verb you might want to use there.
That's it for this week's Reduced Shakespeare Company podcast, except for one more thing, which I'll share with you in about 60 seconds, so stick around. Ann Curzan hosts the podcast That's What They Say from Michigan Public Radio and wrote the wonderful new book, Says Who, a kinder, funner usage guide for everyone who cares about words. Send us how you play with language via email to feedback@reducedshakespeare.com or throw a comment to us over on the socials or on our own actual website, reducedshakespeare.com, or visit my website, theshakespeareans.com. Thanks, as always, to Elizabethan girl dad Matthew Croak, web services by Ginger Power Limited, music by John Weber and GarageBand. Our random fan shout-out this week goes to Trudy Pippin. No reason, it's just random. Special thanks to Guy Roberts, artistic director of Prague Shakespeare Company, who Reed Martin and I will see this week at the Shakespeare Theatre Association's annual conference in San Francisco. And as always, thanks very much to you for listening. I'm Austin Titchener, 944 2830 seconds of the Reduced Shakespeare Company. And this has been such a great, another great conversation, and I'm grateful to you for it, because I love learning about new things and exposing my own ignorance in real time.
Well, you clearly are a Shakespeare expert, and I love the ways in which you're thinking about these connections between Shakespeare's role and importance in the history of the language and how that can help us think about what's happening around us today. And so I thank you for that work, because I think that it all helps us think about this ever-changing language that we get to see and hear all around us.
I'm going to steal an old joke, but I love it. It's from an old friend of mine who taught me this 40 years ago. Yes, I am an expert in the sense that X is an unknown quantity and spurt is a drip under pressure.
Okay, that's good.
It's pretty good. It's worth remembering for 40 years.
This podcast is a production of the Reduced Shakespeare Company, reducing expectations since 1981. Go to reducedshakespeare.com for performance dates, actor bios, email newsletters, and so much less.